Now, this next story is also about a photograph, a much older one, actually a daguerreotype from the mid-19th century.
We've had that daguerreotype. It's always been one of our favorites for close to 40 years.
It's one of the first daguerreotypes Jack Wilgus and his wife Beverly got their hands on when they started a collection of old photos back in the 1960s. Now, this particular photo is of a well-dressed, handsome man with a closed eye, and he's holding a metal rod. And for 40 years, Beverly and Jack Wilgus thought the man was a whaler. But then, last year, they started scanning their old photos and posting them to the online photo-sharing site Flickr, and someone noticed that whaler.
It was actually a comment on the photograph.
That photo, the person wrote, is probably Phineas Gage. And who, you might ask, was Phineas Gage?
One of the most famous medical cases that you know by name.
That's Dominic Hall. He's the curator of the Warren Anatomical Museum at Harvard Medical School.
I talk about Phineas Gage every single day in some context or another.
On September 13th, 1848, 25-year-old Phineas Gage was blasting rocks to make way for what would become the Rutland and Burlington Railroad in Vermont.
That day, while he's doing this process called tamping, which is essentially they're drilling holes in large rock, packing in some sort of explosive powder, packing sand on top of that explosive powder, laying a fuse, and then, you know, and then detonating the fuse.
And he was using a handmade tamping iron to pack those explosives, a 3.5-foot-long iron rod, about an inch in diameter.
You get a couple of different accounts of what happens, but something clearly goes wrong, and a spark sets off the charge, and the rod is actually fired through Gage's head. It goes all the way through, it comes out the top of his skull, and lands about 30 yards away.
The other workers quickly gathered around Phineas Gage as he lay on the ground.
Yeah, they certainly think he's most likely going to die. But he is actually able to, with the help of other people, make it over to an ox cart. He sits up in the ox cart and travels to a local inn where he was staying. And that's where he's attended by these physicians. But he actually never loses consciousness at this point.
He's awake the whole time.
He's awake the whole time. He's able to describe his injury.
For 3 months, a local doctor named John Harlow worked on Gage. It was a crude form of what we might now call neurosurgery. And over the next year or so, Harlow started to notice changes in Gage's personality.
Before, he gets described as businesslike, friendly, maybe efficient, responsible. He's good at managing his team on the railroad. After the accident, he's occasionally referred to as childlike, vulgar. He definitely has some social problems.
Harlow eventually brought Gage to Harvard Medical School to be studied. The students even made a plaster cast of his head, which, along with the iron rod and his actual skull, are still on display at the medical school's museum. Anyway, Gage is examined, and a paper gets published about his condition.
Then he becomes this literal textbook case. He becomes the textbook example.
The textbook example of a post-traumatic personality change. And over the next decade or so, Gage drifted. He spent some of that time as a curiosity act. He worked as a coach driver in Chile. And then he wound up in San Francisco, living with his mother. And in 1860, at the age of 36, Phineas Gage died, the result of seizures most likely related to the accident more than a decade earlier. And up until last year, no one alive really knew what Phineas Gage actually looked like because there were no known photographs or paintings of him. That is, until Beverly Wilgus emailed that scan of her daguerreotype to Dominic Hall at Harvard with a simple question.
Could this be Phineas Gage? And that started the dialogue.
They compared the scars in the image with Gage's skull, and they looked at the iron rod in the photograph and the tamping iron at Harvard's museum, both of which seemed to be engraved with the same inscription.
This is the bar that was shot through the head of Mr. Phineas P. Gage at Cavendish, Vermont, September 14th, 1848.
Dominic Hall was stunned.
It's sort of funny, but I have this sort of close relationship with Phineas Gage because of how often I look at his case and think about his case and talk about his case with other people. And so before, when you're only thinking of Gage, you think of a skull or you think of a life cast. But now there's this image.
And you can see that image at our website. That's npr.org. Right up until the very end, Anne Boleyn professed her innocence. A few days before she was beheaded for plotting to kill her husband, Henry VIII, the fallen queen stood before her accusers.
"My lords, I will not say your sentence is unjust, nor presume that my reasons can prevail against your convictions. I'm willing to believe that you have sufficient reasons for what you have done, but then they must be other than those which have been produced in court, for I am clear of all the offences which you then laid to my charge."
On May 19, 1536, Anne Boleyn was executed on the grounds of the Tower of London. 11 days later, the king married his third wife, Jane Seymour. Now, a lot of ink has been spilled about the Tudor dynasty and Anne Boleyn, and writer Alison Weir has been among the most prolific. She's written historical novels based on that period, but her latest is what she calls a forensic investigation into the last 4 months of Anne Boleyn's life, something that's never been done before. This is a history book, but written with all the intrigue and tension of a novel. It's called The Lady in the Tower, and Alison Weir is in London. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Guy.
This book reads almost like it was written by a private investigator, or maybe a lawyer trying to build a case for Anne.
That's what it felt like.
Trying to build a case for her, for Anne Boleyn. What were you hoping to prove?
I was hoping to look at the case in unprecedented detail, to go into have that scope, to have a whole book in which to write about 4 months, and to see if I could get any closer to what was probably the truth.
Were you, I mean, as you eventually did, trying to acquit her of the charges?
No. In fact, you have to clear your mind when you do something like this of all previous conceptions about it. Look at the evidence anew. And in this case, I was able to study sources that other people had ignored, incredibly. And then at the end, you can make your conclusions from that.
Given that historians have looked at all of these documents and records for hundreds of years and written about Anne Boleyn, were you sort of wondering whether there was anything new to discover about her?
Yes, I was. But in a way, it's good to have the scope to tell that story in unprecedented detail, even if nothing new comes out of it. I wasn't looking for anything new to come out of it. I was wondering if anything would, and it did.
Many people associate Anne Boleyn with England's Protestant Reformation. But you write that Anne was actually trying to restrain Henry VIII from pushing the Reformation too far, too fast.
Yes, it was Thomas Cromwell she was trying to restrain. Thomas Cromwell was the king's principal secretary and the man who was probably the architect of her downfall. Henry VIII, of course, endorsed the coming dissolution of the monasteries. But Cromwell wanted their wealth to go into the royal coffers, as did the king. Anne wanted that wealth used for either reform of the monasteries or for education and charitable purposes.
Now, Thomas Cromwell, who, of course, was Henry VIII's main advisor, he was the person who really built a case against Anne Boleyn. But before we talk about the case, I want to ask you why he was after her.
Originally, he'd been her supporter, but by 1535, a year before her downfall, they'd become rivals, and probably this has something to do with his planned measures in respect to the monasteries. Also, I think he saw her as a threat to his own power. His natural inclinations tended towards an alliance with the emperor, who was the nephew of Catherine of Aragon, and Anne would be an obstacle to that.
Talk about how Thomas Cromwell built the case against Anne.
Well, some of the first evidence is said to have come to him from abroad, from the French court, which we don't know what it was. But he himself said that there were rumours going around the Queen's household about her infidelities, and that her servants became so shocked that they couldn't keep it to themselves any longer, and they came and you know, revealed what they had heard to himself and other members of the Privy Council. And thereafter, interrogations took place of every member of her household.
Many historians have looked at the evidence and have concluded that it was at best flawed, but most likely just wrong, just made up.
That's true.
But what do you make of it? I mean, when you actually look at the evidence, was it, I mean, you come to the conclusion that it was wrong, but was it actually crafted in a way that was convincing?
The problem is, most of the evidence doesn't survive. But it was sufficient at the time to convince the king, Cromwell, and 97 judges and jurors that Anne was guilty. But if you look at the surviving evidence, and a lot of it's inferential, a lot of it's circumstantial, and you look at the reasons for her innocence and the case for her guilt, you will find an overwhelming case for her innocence almost to be conclusive.
Now, Alison, we are tourists who go to the Tower of London. We'll see the place where Anne Boleyn was killed. They'll see the place where it's thought she was buried. They will see the tower, which, of course, is why your book is named The Lady in the Tower. You've uncovered information to suggest that a lot of what we thought we knew is wrong.
Yes, I was quite astonished, actually, to uncover this. All these revelations came towards the end of my research. I did discover quite a few things about her imprisonment, namely that she wasn't executed where people think she was. She wasn't imprisoned where people think she was. She's not buried where people think she was. The executioner, I now know, I've been able to establish, was sent for before her trial, thus preempting the verdict.
That's Alison Weir. She's the author of the new biography, The Lady in the Tower, The Fall of Anne Boleyn, and she joined me from our studio in London. Alison Weir, thank you.
Thank you, Guy.
The shapes in high fashion magazines may be changing. The latest issue of V, for example, is dedicated to models of all sizes. So curvy figures as well as slim ones are featured in its glossy pages. Joining us from our New York bureau is Christopher Bartley, the features editor of V magazine. Hi, Christopher.
Hello, how are you?
And he is joined by plus-size supermodel Emmy. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Leanne. I'm so happy to be here.
Oh, it's nice to have you both. And Christopher, I'd like to start with you because this issue of V, it's called the size issue, and it features actresses Dakota Fanning and Gabourey Sidibe from the movie Precious. Now, these two women could physically not be more different.
Exactly.
But the one thing they do have in common is the fact that they're both great actresses. But as a features editor, was there something behind in your mind when you juxtaposed these two?
Well, Gabby actually inspired the issue in a way, along with Crystal Wren, who we'll touch on later. But we saw the trailer for Precious in the office over the summer, and we just fell in love with her.
Emmy, I want to bring you in because on your blog, you highlight some points in the debate over this V magazine issue and wrote that some people consider it a bold move on the magazine's part, but others say that full-sized women should be featured in every issue. Where do you stand on that?
Every issue.
Every issue.
Yeah. It shouldn't be an issue of size. It should be women. And I think that the media, especially women's magazines, would do themselves a favor if they truly, truly did this, because it would reduce so much of the horrible push for the pre-pubescent image, the drive for thinness, the unrealistic expectations, I feel, that are just delivered to us day in and day out.
Christopher, you're nodding assent. I can hear you when Emmy's talking about having other-sized women featured in every issue. But is a promotional effort, this one, or will V magazine continue to use models of all sizes?
We absolutely will continue. But, I mean, I do believe that anything has to start with a revolution of sorts. Like, you have to be radical, and then conversations start from there.
Go, Christopher, go.
You know, like.
Right. And also, Leanne, I have to jump in. I know Cindy Levy over at Glamour Magazine, she has made a commitment last year to have size 12s and 14s and 10s, and then also booking models that are size 6 and size 4 together in editorial spreads. Now, that is where we're going.
Emmy, in the modeling world, what's considered a plus size?
In the modeling world, some might say 10, but I kind of laugh hysterically at that. 12, 14, and then 16 is kind of a fall off for print. So the women that work are 12, 14s and a solid 14.
Do you find the term plus size to be derogatory?
Degrading? Yes. Because it's obvious that we are fuller and shapelier and have a little bit of sexiness.
Sure.
A lot of sexiness to us. So.
But plus size doesn't necessarily mean obese or unfit.
Absolutely. There's this controversy that some people think that we sit back and kick back the milkshakes and the bonbons and all that. But in order to be a model, you have to train, you have to eat well, you have to think well of yourself, and you have to be like a natural German, Polish, big bone gal who likes to take care. And it's natural. It's a natural shape.
I'm speaking with supermodel Emmy and Christopher Bartley, who's the features editor of V Magazine, about the new size issue, which is on the newsstands now. Christopher, in the size issue, you have some pretty skillful photoshopping to show, a skinny and heavier version of the same model wearing the same clothes.
That's actually two different models.
Is it really?
Yeah, that's two different.
All right. Well, what was the motivation for doing this?
Well, that story specifically was to show that the same runway samples which are a size 2, could be worn on a runway model and Crystal Wren. In each spread, there's a model wearing her size 2 sample. She looks great. Mm-hmm. Then on the right, there's Crystal Wren wearing the same exact outfit, and she looks amazing as well.
And, so, and we're talking Versace. You know, we're talking
Versace,
Armani.
Princess Cooler.
Yeah.
I've had to cut clothes up the back to demand the look that is on the runway can right. look great on a body that's a 14.
It's an interesting conversation to have when there's such a push now against obesity.
Correct. We definitely have a bipolar problem with our health in this country. One end, horrendous obesity. And on the other side, that's not talked about, and I'm glad to be able to bring this up, is another epidemic of anorexia, bulimia, associated disorders that are not really talked about. It's messy and it doesn't look great. That's where the drive to be thin, thin, thin at all costs. And even women who are below a size 12 are the ones that are using more of the diet products than the ones that are above a size 12. You just kind of scratch your head and go, what is going on here? When are we going to shake ourselves?
Christopher Bartley is the features editor of V Magazine, and Emmy is a supermodel and TV personality. They joined us from our New York bureau, and you can find more about V Magazine's size issue on our blog. Go to npr.org/soapbox. Thanks, both of you.
Thank you,
Thank you so much.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. This week, President Obama gives his first official report on the State of the Union to Congress and the nation. The primetime address Wednesday night would be widely anticipated under any circumstances, but it comes at a time of stubborn high unemployment and economic resentment throughout the country. It's also a moment of great stress for the Democratic president and his majorities in the House and Senate. Party leaders are discussing how to complete their health care legislation and proceed with the president's agenda after the loss of their 60th vote in the Senate. Joining us to talk about the week ahead and the challenges beyond is NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning, Leanne.
So much bad news for the Democrats last week. They lost Ted Kennedy's seat in Massachusetts. The Supreme Court threw out the ban on corporations funding campaigns, and the number of new jobless claims went up. I mean, what do you think? Is this the worst possible moment for the president to give a State of the Union speech?
You could say that. You could also say it's highly opportune because it's clearly time for something different from the White House. And here's a chance to offer something different while you have the nation's attention. He needs to change the storyline. And right now, giving a speech is probably his best chance for doing that.
Do you know what he's going to say?
He's going to say he's listening to what the country is saying. He's learning from his reversals and setbacks. He's going to focus on jobs and the economy, of course, and they're going to talk about rescuing and restoring and rebuilding the economy. He's also going to sound more conciliatory on some things, I think, especially health care. And at the same time, there's also going to be a counter message, if you will, of confrontation. You know, he's bringing back David Plouffe, who was the campaign manager in 2008, and they want some issues that will allow them to reconnect with the populist energy that they were riding back then and that some conservatives and Republicans seem to be riding now. So they'll be pushing their new tax on big bonuses in the banks and some new size and risk limits on those banks.
Explain why he needs to be conciliatory on the health bill. Go back to that.
Well, I think that's his best chance of salvaging something there. The House, you know, could pass the Senate version of the bill tomorrow and the president could sign it into law, but right now the votes aren't there for that in the House. So the sponsors of the bill need to regroup. They need to go beyond the Congress to the care providers and the insurers and the interest groups and say, help us. You were with us before. We all thought we needed to get something done. Let's figure out how we refashion this thing and bring at least a few Republicans over in the Senate. If they could do that, it would make it more popular in the country and change the calculus for the House.
But Senate Republicans seem to be united against this bill. Do you think that strategy will work?
You know, the Republicans have been united against this bill, especially since the Democrats got 60 votes 6 months ago. Now, when that happened, people said, Democrats have the votes to do what they want. They're just going to be a big legislation machine. But the mirage of that supermajority of 60 seemed to make the Senate worse. And the Republicans shut down completely at that point on cooperation, voting in lockstep against everything, even things that they liked. And several individual Democrats played games by withholding the 60th vote, cutting special deals for themselves. And that trashed the public image of the bill.
In 20 seconds, can you tell us if everybody feels so badly, how is it going to pass?
Well, of course, the bill's fate at this point is uncertain, and the bill itself also remains largely a mystery to most people. They just see the deal-making and the disappointment and the finger-pointing, so they tell the pollsters they're against it. If you ask people about the basic provisions of the bill, they do pretty well, so you have to reassemble the coalition outside Congress, streamline the vehicle, and present it again.
Well done. NPR Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Leanne.